I mean, you know, you have 500 degree swing, you know, in a spacesuit. You know, you, one side you could have 250, the other side, theoretically, is in the shade to be 250. But they don't worry about the heat because the body, your body is putting off, especially when you're working over 300 watts, they say. So, you know, their biggest problem is getting rid of the heat. And the same with the space station. Heat is a problem. And that's why they have those reflecting radiators, getting rid of infrared heat. That's how they do it. There's no convection involved, of course. You're in a vacuum. But, you know, when you read about how much power the space station has, they like to use, they convert it to homes. People, you know, most people understand, okay, I got a house. What's the most my house is going to draw? So they said if every house has 4 kW at the time it's being used, you could run 40 houses. So if you take the 128, you know, kilowatts and divide that by 40 houses, you wind up with, I think it's like 3,200 or something. 3,200, I think, was the number. Watts per house. But so it's really more than that because you have, you know, we're talking about solar panels on the American side. The Russian side has some solar panels, and you add it up and it comes out to roughly 4,000 watts per, you know, per house. So if you have 40 houses, that's the way it would work out. So you could power up 40 homes up there with the space station. Incredible amount of power. And to get rid of the heat, you have the ammonia system. You have all your, they have a lot of, like, circulating lines inside the space station going to all the equipment. I read not too long ago they were hooking up radio equipment for eventually having the docking of the new crewed spacecraft coming up. So they're hooking up the radio equipment. One of the first things they do is hook up these little cooling connectors. You know, they're really water connectors. And they're piped out, you know, small tubes, and they collectively they all, you know, manifold together and wind up going to heat exchanges actually on the outside part of the, you know, it's actually between the modules, but they have these heat exchanges, and then from there the water gets converted to he gets transferred to the ammonia, and then they have big pumps outside the space station, and the pumps pump the ammonia to the radiators. But the radiators, most of the heat they're getting from is from the outside electronics too, before it gets into the space station. The solar panels are running, going to the batteries, and they have all kind of electronics that are connected to the outside of the space station, creating heat. They have ammonia connected directly to it, and that ammonia in turn gets pumped to these big radiators. By the way, the radiators rotate too. They move. They're on motors. They have, they call them alpha gimbals and beta gimbal systems. And those things are turning, you know, if you have the sun's rays coming directly at the solar panels, know, they keep the panels turned directly toward the sun. The radiators actually turn 90 degrees of the solar panels at all times because they don't want the sun to hit the panels. They want it to hit edge on, and actually it gives up most of the heat. Works best at night. That's when the panels give up the heat. That's the best time for them to do their job. K2RIW WS2N.
So essentially all of that electrical power, per se, generated by those solar panels, solar voltaics, eventually turns into heat after it runs all the machinery on the inside of the International Space Station. All of that heat has to be dumped back out. So my next question to Paul is, you probably have seen the diagrams. Give me a rough guess. What's the total area of the fins that do the heat radiating on the outside, that are always running at night, 90 degree angle compared to the sun, so that they're not picking up solar energy? Roughly, what is their area? I'm going to guess it's getting close to a fraction a good fraction of the area of the solar panels. They got an awful lot of heat to dump. Now, the one thing that could help them, you could say it's got ammonia in it. In the early days of refrigeration, ammonia was used as the gas in the refrigerators that was generating ice. Your ice house ran on ammonia in the early days. And later on, we came along with what we think are more efficient things like Freon 12 and Freon 22. But ammonia in a refrigeration system, an air conditioning system, could be running in such a way that you've got an evaporator core on the inside of the International Space Station, and you've got a condenser core on the outside, and you've got a refrigeration pump in between. So I think it's a real refrigeration system running on ammonia. You're not just simply circulating ammonia from inside to outside. I don't think that would do it. Well, then again, maybe. Maybe if all of those heat radiating panels are simply aimed at a cold part of space, where they want to go down to something in the vicinity of 3 degrees Kelvin, maybe no mechanical refrigeration pump is required in between, just circulate it at the right rate. So I've got a couple questions there. Is it a real refrigeration system with a compressor, an evaporator core, and a condenser core, or is it just simply flowing the fluid between the cold plate on the outside and the hot plates on the inside? And what's the approximate area of those heat radiating systems? I think they've got to be radiating down close to 128 kilowatts per pole. The RS2N, K2RIW.
I forget their surface area, but they have four. They're long, you know. I think each one is like 60 feet long or something. There's four on the starboard side, four on the port side. So, four sets on each side. They got to take up, you know, probably 300-400 square feet. But, there's ammonia, just like you have Freon 22 and Freon 12, you have, I think ammonia has a designation as well, 917, they have a number for that. But that would be for a refrigeration system, where you have a compressor, evaporator, condenser, you know, TX valve in between. You have none of that, no capillary tubes, zero. You have a pump, and you pump ammonia they're going to pick up the heat from the inside of the space station through the converters, and then they're going to pump them directly to the fins. You got to think of what we have here on Earth in these big buildings. You have these big cooling towers, and those, a lot of them have a glycol system going through it. It's water with glycol in it, so it doesn't freeze. And you have big pumps driving the water with the glycol in it, and those go through the heat exchanges inside the building. You might be picking up heat anywhere inside any building. To get rid of it, they have to go to the cooling towers. To go to the cooling towers, you have tremendous big pipes pumping and pumping water with glycol in it up to the cooling towers to get rid of the heat. Now, why don't they just use plain old water? Because it would freeze. The freezing problem would be, you know, that's bad news. You can't do that. Same type of thing in space. You know, they would love to just run water through the pipes, through the pumps, from, you know, from one system to the other. Stop fooling around with all this dangerous glycol that they have to, ammonia that they have to worry about. If they have an ammonia leak, a couple times they thought they did. They have to evacuate the space station and go into the Soyuz spacecraft and wait, make sure that there's no leak. So that's what they're doing. They're pumping ammonia from one place to the other in a liquid form. Nothing to do with a refrigeration effect. Back to you there.
Okay, I'm going to did not use glycol with water, because as you add the glycol to water, I think you can bring the freezing temperature down to like minus 30 Fahrenheit. I don't think you'd go a lot further than that. And those cold coils in space, in the worst case condition, when you're on the backside of the Earth and they're aimed at cold space, they could go to some ridiculous temperature like a minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So therefore they'd be using ammonia and not glycol water. Do you happen to know what is the freezing temperature of liquid ammonia? And it might be a little bit of a function of what pressure it's under. And I can see why. I think ammonia, if it turns into a gas, I believe it's fairly poisonous. I'm pretty sure you don't want to breathe it. So they probably have various detectors looking for a few molecules of ammonia gas, giving you forewarning that a leak has just begun to happen.
Good comment, Dick.
Yeah, give me some words on that, John. You seem to know more about ammonia than I do. Go ahead.
I was going to mention glycol, another use which Paul is probably aware of. When it's used for cooling, glycol has a problem. It can solidify, and boy, you have a problem then. And to desolidify and to go back is a major issue. So I'm sure Paul has run into that in his work. But ammonia, I don't know the freezing point of ammonia. It has to be extremely low.
When you get the glycol giving you a solid material, is that when you overheat it, John? In other words, if my radiator ran too hot, do I start making a solid paste out of the glycol?
It has to do with the restriction in the circulating system, from what I understand. I know they had that problem in many of the boiler plants that I was in, and they would go crazy when that would solidify. It would solidify in the base, not in the cooling tower. Another problem with the cooling towers is when you send the glycol up to the cooling towers, that's all contained, but they have a washboard that water runs over where these pipes are, and that's why they can't be run in the winter time, because that water that is cooling the glycol freezes, and that's another major issue. Yeah, a lot of problems with glycol.
John, are you talking about the absorption machines?
Yes. Glycol absorption. You got it.
And by the way, one of the words you were looking for, real cool, I'm assuming that the space people use the same words as the military people. The plate that gets cold inside of the line replaceable units of the B-1 bomber are called chill plates. So the cold plate is called the chill plate that picks up the heat from the electronics. In our case, the Coulinol was the fluid that brings the heat in that Coulinol fluid out to a heat exchanger somewhere. So do you happen to know the freezing temperature of ammonia? Is it running under pressure? And I think I had another question, but tell us whatever you know about this, Paul. I'm curious. They've got some serious problems here that they've solved. Over to you, Paul, KQLAW.
I know they use the ammonia because it won't freeze under pressure. If they lose the pressure, they've had some leaks. You can see that it comes out, it looks like snowflakes, gets on the astronauts' clothes, and they were panicky about it. Dick, I heard a comment out there, but he's pretty noisy.
Yeah, there's a person who said comment. Speak to us slowly. You are extremely noisy, and maybe you can do something to increase your signal, and go ahead with your comment or question. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Hey, Dick, it's Craig, KD2CXK. Can you hear me? Do you copy?
Yes, Craig, we're hearing you fairly good. Go ahead, Craig.
You just need a simple heat source. I ammonia refrigerator in my van, and it has no compressor. Is the compressor? I was in cold design, and it is a...
Craig, either you're mobile or you're on a handy talkie and you're moving around. You were there one third of the time. So we heard a couple of words from time to time, but you were not a steady, and we didn't get a coherent message out of that. Is there some way you can steady that signal? Could the handy talkie stop moving, connect it to a real antenna, or whatever? Mr. CXK, go right ahead.
I believe he was claiming that the operation of an ammonia refrigerator We used to have ammonia refrigerators. They ran on a gas pilot. Very little heat to do it. I think that's what he was trying to explain. Let's see if he has a better position.
The absorption. We gotta make it. We'll try it again.
Craig, want to give it another try? Mr. CXK, EQRIW. Okay, so maybe we can make some guesses as to what Craig was trying to tell us, Paul. Do you think the ammonia is running under pressure? Is it just simply a pump pushing the liquid ammonia? Or do you think some kind of minor refrigeration is going on between a higher pressure on the heat exchanger side and on the chill plate side, and lower pressure on the other side? I think what we've gathered so far, it appears as though the ammonia stays in liquid form continuously, and all they've got to do is circulate it. And hopefully the ammonia freezes at a low enough temperature that it's very unlikely to freeze on that outside heat exchanger. That's what I think we've guessed here, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, they have nitrogen bottles inside the in the pumping tanks to keep a constant pressure on it. Like I said before, if they have a leak, it goes out to the vacuum. It comes off, looks like snowflakes. So they can't. You know, it's got to be under some pressure. I don't know what the PSI is on the in the system, but it's just under a constant pressure. There's no high side. There's no low side. And by the way, you got to look for Craig's astronomy. That's on Tuesday nights. Look for KD2CXK runs the best astronomy night, probably in the country. So I can't hear him tonight. I guess he was mobile. Good evening, Craig. So yeah, okay, Dick. We'll turn it back to you. Any questions? We'll talk about new rockets, new companies that are involved. Company Firefly, they're getting ready to test their rocket in 2017. We got a new Alpha rocket. They're going to send up small payloads. We go on and on here, Dick. Back to that.
I've got one last question on this heat exchanger. The heat exchanger radiating area, which is kept at right angles to the sun, is that a completely separate ammonia rotary joint system? Or are those heat exchangers somehow connected to the solar panels and just mounted at right angles on the solar panels? How do those heat exchangers, I think you said you got four of them on the starboard side and four of them on the port side. I'm having trouble picturing. They've got to rotate in a manner somewhat like the solar panels in order to keep them aimed in the right direction at the right time to dump the heat into the cold part of space. Over to you, Paul. K2RIW.
Yeah, well, they're mounted a little closer in, so I think they just have a what you would call a beta rotation. You might remember these big joints, they going after big solar panels. They had the alpha joints, and they had some problems with the with metal filings on one of them, and they eventually had to do an EBA, clean it up, and try to re-grease it with some kind of a futuristic grease. And they call them the alpha rotation joints. And each setup was about as like big as a Volkswagen, and that would turn to rotate this whole structure. You'd be able to do four sets of solar panels going out on one side. They'd have the starboard alpha rotation set up, and then on the opposite side of the space station, they'd have the port side alpha, and they call that the alpha. That would turn one way. And then each of the solar panels have motors on them, and they're called beta. So they rotate in the opposite, 90 degrees from the alpha. They'll turn those solar panels to face the sun properly. sure, but I'm pretty sure the radiators, they just have the beta capability, as far as I remember. Back to you, Dick.
So the ammonia system has got a rotary joint on each of its radiators, and that rotary joint has to have a good liquid seal, and I'm going to guess the ammonia is running under some kind of pressure. You might know what pressure it runs at. Maybe ammonia is only in the liquid form above a certain pressure, and maybe if it goes down to 14.7, it turns into a gas. There, I'm not sure. So now you've got a rotary joint with a pressurized fluid on one side, and so how well that rotary joint keeps its seal. And there's a finite number of rotations that it can tolerate before the seal wears down and you start leaking on the outside. I think you said they did develop a leak on the inside, and they saw some white flakes on the spacesuit. I wonder if they've ever had a leak on the outside. So, any idea what pressure the ammonia is running at, the Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Well, the pumps are running, but I don't know how many gallons a minute they're pushing it around. I don't know that, and I know that there's a static pressure, and that's being done by, they have a nitrogen charge on it, and they're able to keep the pressure that way. No, but I don't know how many PSI it is. I don't even, it has nothing to do with inside the space station, so there's no reason to keep it at 14.7. Probably just enough pressure to make it so that when it drops down to, what is it, -250 degrees, whatever the pressure temperature relation chart is, I could look that up, a regular PT chart, just like you have for all the refrigerants. Ammonia is a refrigerant. And you could make sure that the pressure is high enough where that when you get to -250 degrees, your ammonia won't start evaporating, or worse than that, freeze up. And the leaks were caused, we're actually near the valves. When the astronauts were working on this, they found the leaks. They would open and close the valve, and see the little snowflakes coming out of there, bouncing off the spacesuits. I had to make sure when I went back inside that they had no residual ammonia on them. You can't get ammonia inside the space, the ammonia gas inside the space station. So, all these things are considered. Back to you, Dick.
Comment? Person with comment? Identify yourself and go right ahead.
Dick, it's Craig. Can you just get, hey, I got a better signal now, I would think. No?
Fantastic. Whatever you did, do more of it, Craig. You sound great. Please repeat any of the above, any of your previous material.
Okay. Well, first thing with ammonia, an ammonia system runs at a much lower pressure than an R12 or a 134A or a 22 system. It's highly efficient, much more efficient than any standard fluorocarbon refrigerant or anything like that. You do not require a compressor to perform the heat and cooling cycle. The only thing you really need is the heat source, 250 degrees to fine, and proper metered orifice. So this system is self-contained, sealed with no moving parts, working by convection alone. It'll chill enough to create ice at one side. It's a real simple system. I have an ammonia refrigerator that is solid state. It has no moving parts whatsoever, except the door that opens and closes. That is the only moving part in the unit, and it runs by a tiny little propane-powered lamp that is no bigger than a big lighter, and I can make ice cubes in about 2 hours. KD2CXK, back over to Mexico.
WS2N.
Yeah, I do remember reading stories about people having a gas, a natural gas-powered refrigerator in, way back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, I guess it was, when people were using those things. No moving parts. It's hard to believe you can get the cooling
it. Basically, an the ammonia system was the absorption system before they had compressors. So to create the high side, you would have the little heat that Craig's talking about, and that would heat up the ammonia. And then we go through these different points, orifices, and you'd eventually have a high side and low side with the cooling effect of it, the condensing of it. And, he's right. I believe it's roughly half the amount of BTUs per pound of equal weight. In other words, let's say you had a pound of water, that would be 970 BTUs. And ammonia, I think that, like you said, is very efficient. I think it's like 400 and something BTUs per pound. And you compare that to your freons. Your freons, you have like, 70 BTUs per pound, or, numbers like that, Big, big difference. And, now you scale that up, what Craig is talking about, to what John is talking about. And he says John's talking about the big absorption machines that you would have in a building, and they would eventually, they call it salt up. And it's the same idea. You wouldn't have any compressors, and you could do a, you could do a skyscraper with this thing. You would have ammonia being heated by steam. You'd have steam pipes connected to the ammonia setup, and it would evaporate the ammonia, and you'd go through this whole setup, and then in turn that would eventually get down to the brine problem, they would call it solving up, and you'd have nothing but problems. You have guys down there with torches trying to heat it up to get it running again. I believe that's what John was talking about. But you could have basically what Craig is talking about, except on a large scale, huge buildings doing the same thing. It's called the absorption machine, the absorption cycle setup. Back to you, Dick.
That's exactly the cycle I was talking about. By the way, Dick, that's R717, I believe, ammonia. Minus 28 degrees is the boiling point. I think that's Fahrenheit.
R717. Beautiful. Craig, this flame-powered ammonia refrigerator you own, roughly how many cubic feet? Roughly how many dollars? What brand name? That sounds like a fun machine. KD2CXK, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, it is a small refrigerator. It's probably about 2 cubic feet. It'll run on 12 volts, 110 volts, or propane. All three heat sources achieve the same principle, heating the reservoir of ammonia, which starts the evaporation and the absorption, condensing, all that process. It's a very closed-loop system. It's incredibly efficient. It is, I think I worked out the numbers that it was about, 19 or 20 times more efficient than a Freon system. I can run this refrigerator 24 hours a day, and it will, because I do in the summers, I start the fridge about June, and it'll run 24 hours a day until September on, I think, 6 gallons of propane straight. KD2CXK, back to that.
Boy, that sounds great. I wonder if it has a so-called EER rating. In the case of a Freon 22 air conditioner for my house, an EER rating of 12 is considered quite good. I wonder if this thing has a similar number. So it's around 2 cubic feet. Sounds beautifully efficient. What brand name and how many dollars, Craig? Sounds like you've owned it for a couple of years. Sounds like a fun thing. KD2CXK, K2LAW.
Yes, Dick, there's really one go-to company for all of these, and they make them in full-size home-style refrigerators. The company is Dometic, Delta, Oscar, Mike, Echo, Tango, India, Charlie, I think is the best way. It's always Dometic. And they've been making them for many, many years. This system is, you can buy these used for about, I would say $100, $150. Off-gridders in Alaska and people who want to move off-grid always switch to ammonia refrigerated systems because of the cost. Incredibly inexpensive to run. It is not uncommon for a home-style refrigerator, a large refrigerator you would find in a home, to be able to run for no more than about $30 a year. Back to you, Nick. Can you do this?
Considering the reliability it sounds like it has, with, like you said, the only moving part is the door. Wow. That thing must have extremely high reliability, as long as you don't do something dumb like allowing the freezer section to coat up with ice that's a foot thick, and the thermal and the expansion of the ice, you know, break a coil. I'm curious as to why more of us are not using this. Why is this not a popular idea? It sounds too good to be true. Why is not our domestic refrigerator in each of our homes this kind of refrigerator, Craig? KD2CXK, K2RIW?
I think there was a comment, but it's probably for the reason of safety. I mean, we all know ammonia is a very, very dangerous gas to play with. It is as toxic as cyanide or mercury or anything else in close proximity in good enough quantities. Freon doesn't produce those health hazards. I mean, I know in the past, when I was a kid, I was chipping ice out of a refrigerator and I pierced the coil and all the freon came out and I got yelled at like no other, and my parents had to buy a new refrigerator. If I was an ammonia system, I probably wouldn't be on the radio with you right now. So that's really, I would say, one reason. They do seem to have an operational life of about 50 years, which, of course, you know, is better than almost any refrigerator made. I guess that's pretty much it. It would probably just be health concerns. K2RIW, K2CXK, and I think there was somebody breaking in the comments.
They used to make them out of methane as well, I remember.
K2XDX with a comment.
Okay, something KX. We'll go to you in a second. In the case of you think it's only good for 50 years, well, even before you get to 50 years, by the time you go 30 years, you've got to replace the rubber. You've got to replace the rubber seal around the door. Otherwise, air is leaking in. Who's the other person with a comment? Give us your full call letters and name, sir, and then proceed with your comment. K2RIW.
Thanks, Dick. It's John, K2AKX, and I'm in the appliance business. And right now, not in the United States, but in France, they're running R600 butane. GE, I think in the year 2019, will be importing them into the United States. We're not going to be using Freon in refrigeration anymore. We're going to be using butane. How's that in the story? Kind of like going around in a back circle. You know, what goes around comes around. We're losing ammonia, and we're coming back and using butane.
They have methane. That was the original refrigerator, and now it's too methane, right?
Got a comment on that, John?
Well, in the camping industry, that's why Craig has that three-way system. That's always been very popular in campers and mobile homes. For the capability of having three-way power, 12 volts, 110, and then, of course, most cobalt homes had propane tanks on them for cooktops to cook, so it made it very easy to make refrigeration using ammonia. I think back in the late 50s, I think we got away from using ammonia. Again, if the gas did escape and there was an open flame, it was very highly flammable. And you had to use a lot of it, so it contained a lot of ammonia. The butane, as I understand it, the refrigerators that they're using in France, use such a small amount of butane that it could be about the amount of liquid in a cigarette lighter.
Wow. Now, ammonia, you're saying, is toxic. How much becomes toxic? In the case of Craig's portable refrigerator used for camping, if you're using it outdoors and it starts leaking, that doesn't sound so dangerous. If it was inside of a closed house, that sounds a lot more dangerous. Is one drop of ammonia something to worry about? Where's the threshold of danger when ammonia, I presume it comes out in liquid form, and then does it turn into a gas when it hits your floor? What do you think about safety on that one, John? KD2AKX, K2LAW.
I got zapped with the stuff, Dick. WS2N.
Well, we're going to go to John and then Paul in that order. John first, go ahead.
Hi, Dick. Thanks for the comeback. Well, I'm only 61 years old, and back in the days, the 50s, I don't think I was old enough to be playing around with ammonia systems and refrigeration. So I guess you'd have to go back and speak to an old technician to find out exactly what the problem was. If I had to say it, it probably was very, very dangerous. Maybe some people did get sick or did die from the ammonia gas in the refrigerator. And it is highly flammable. The only problem with the R freon that we use today is that if it does mix with a flame, it turns into what we call 5-mean gas, and that is very toxic. And unfortunately, I've heard stories of people getting very sick, not waiting to evacuate the gas out of a refrigerator when they let it drop, and using an open flame when gas is still coming out of a sealed system on a refrigerator. And unfortunately, small animals in the house, such as birds, have extinguished from the 5-mean gas.
Okay. Paul, you said you got zapped. Make a guess as to what was the concentration, how much, were you in a building where a certain amount of it spilled on the floor? Give us some details. And, when you got zapped, how sick were you, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Dick, the volume of expansion was 850, by the way.
Wow. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, first a comment about the freon. Yeah, in the presence of an open flame, but usually you have to have, like, you got to be heating up copper or something. Like spodging gas. Flame itself, although I want to take a chance. I took over welding pipes from somebody else, and they had left, and I continued on. And yeah, it was 100%. One of the joints that I was on a roof. I got one whiff of that, and it was like somebody took two needles, put it on the thing. I mean, and I was on a roof, you know. Yeah. I don't think you'd last too long. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, I'm hearing you beautiful on the input. And the guy in Queens is showing up beautifully on our map. My goodness, he's a sad case. So it felt like a hammer hitting you. That's what I think you said, Paul. I was busy doing something else, and I missed a couple of the details. It took what length of time of how much exposure for you to get that super headache, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Immediately. No, like you took a nail and put it up your nose and then hit the nail with the hammer. That type of thing. Very sharp shooting pain right up your nose. And I was on a roof. And if you were in a closed space, you'd have a serious problem. You wouldn't last long. I would say you'd probably last a minute. Not even.
Okay, during that exposure, Paul, did your nose tell you you're smelling something? Or is it one of these situations? Is it one of these situations when you don't smell? first thing you know is you're getting sick. So when you were, did your nose tell you you're being exposed? Did your nose tell you you're being exposed? Oh, your palm.
The same guy. Yes. You don't know what's happening until it's over. So, you know, I mean, I was all right. 5 minutes later, I was okay. But you couldn't last like that. You know, they shut the system down. I repaired whatever they had to be repaired, and they were off to the races. I can see this is going to be a problem. So I'm going to say Happy Easter or whatever's left of it. Back to you, Dick. 73.
Okay, Paul. Thank you for all the information. Okay, you guys just heard technet number 1595. It's basically squad number 194. 73, you all. We'll be back next week. And we're going to pass it over to John and Paul in that order. KC2WGB to tie some ribbons. K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Question.
K2WGB. Want to thank everybody for joining the net and the questions that were submitted. Very good. And if everything goes well, we'll be speaking again next week. Same time, same repeater. And I think there was somebody in there, Dick. 7-3, gentlemen. Enjoy.
Yeah, I think that was Joe.
West wind. Other station, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that was Joe. Pick him up in a second. John, what did you see on the Echo Link tonight? Being a holiday, was it pretty light? Over to you, John.
Yes, it was very light. Five, let me see, the maximum was six. And then it would drop to three and then go to four. It was, you know, coming in and out, but quite light.
You got it, Paul.
Be here next week. So 73, have a good night. Glad everybody was here. Made a good net. Back to you, Dick.
And Joe, was that you I was hearing, W2LYY, who had a question?
Yes, W2LYY. Did you receive anything sent to you?
I sure did. Extremely high resolution pictures. Lots of megabytes per picture. I'm not sure I needed quite that amount of resolution, but it certainly very clearly illustrated what you've done. That's why I wanted to have that discussion tonight on that subject. You've done some great work on that antenna tuner. And lots of people have got pretty crazy opinions about antenna tuners. They're accusing it of things that it's not fair. So I guess you weren't available earlier, Paul. John. Here we go. Joe. W2LYY, K2RIW.
Yeah, I was busy with some other things, so I just wanted to make sure you got the, what I sent you. That's good. Okay. As you would say, bye-bye for now.
Out of curiosity, did you have a way of cutting those pictures down in resolution? I had no trouble copying that many megabytes. But if you wanted to send me less megabytes, I wonder if you had the ability to do that. My son does, instantaneously. I do not. I'm not enough of a computer maven. Over to you, Joe.
Yes, well, here's my mail program. It says, do you want to keep the thing at the full original size? Or if you shrink it down, you can send it with, you know, smaller kilobytes of size or megabytes of size, but it changed the resolution. You know, so I want to make sure you had the best picture possible.
Okay, I thank you. K2IW is clear. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other.
Mobile.
tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club Repeater System, node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link clear.
Auto-connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link active.
Tonight at 8:30, W2VL repeater system. Tonight at 8:30, welcome to the W2VL repeater. tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. WQVL Repeater System.